Okay.
Okay. Okay. It's her machine, and I know how to do it now. I can't play it back, but it will work. Could you please tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Poland, Radom.
Would you tell me your name, please?
My name is Sala Apel, my maiden name. Now it's Sarah Adler.
Tell me a little bit about your family.
Well, we had a very large family on both sides. I had a sister and a brother, and grandparents, uncles, cousins, aunts, and...
What was your life like before the war?
A wonderful life. This is the few years I was at home made me survive. The morale from home, the goodness, the Jewish upbringing, this is what kept me going when I was in Auschwitz and in labor camp.
Did your family belong to any of the Jewish community groups?
Absolutely.
Tell me.
It was a very well-known family in the city of Radom, and pretty well-to-do. So my family was very much involved in the synagogues and the community and supporting the poor and so on.
Were there any specific organizations that you belonged to with any other names that you remember?
Well, myself?
Your family?
I couldn't recall. I only recall that the organizations, my uncle, I was very young, they belonged to the Beitar.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. How would you describe your family's relations with non-Jews in the community?
Well, we happen to be surrounded only with Gentile people. Mm-hmm. Our business was there. And as a child, I don't recall anything specific. I just know that we were in business.
As a child, did you have any Gentile friends?
No, because I went to a school where we had mostly Jewish children.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recall any Gentile friends.
During the years from 1933 to 1939, how did the Nazi control of Germany affect your life?
My personal life, I can't say anything, but I was going to school and we were hearing about the Czechoslovakia and this and that and the other. So I didn't know anything about politics because I was very young. And till 1939, I went to school till the Germans came in.
Well, just one moment. Before the Germans came in, did your family ever talk about leaving?
At that point, I don't think so. I heard anything because they were very much involved in the community and in business.
And there was no question of leaving?
At that time, no.
Mm-hmm. And then what happened?
Then in 39, we heard that the Germans are coming, and they sure came in like lions. And my father and my uncle, which my father had a family with small children, and my uncle had a family with small children, the first thing we tried to go away from Radom, because they were bombarding, and the family was afraid that, we might get killed right
from
the bombs.
Who was bombarding?
The Germans, the Nazis. And so we hired a horse and buggy, a man who carried these things, and we put in my father, my mother, got together some clothes, and my aunt and uncle and my little cousins, and we went away for a few days to a little town to escape the bombarding. And I remember when they occupied already Radom, I was crying constantly. It affected me terrible. So my father decided that he has to go back to Radom to see what happened with the business. And my uncle, the same. He had a hardware store, and we had a lumber yard. See, was everything in the family. Was a close family, all right. And my grandparents and uncles were still home. So I walked with my father a Friday morning, we decided. In fact, a neighbor too we met, he had a shoe store, and we walked home, if you call it home. We came back into the city, and we went home, because my grandparents were there, and uncles and cousins and others. And we talked, and we saw that no good. So I overheard that my single uncles, which were an aunt, since my grandmother was a great person, she was so smart, she gave a suggestion right then and there that they should escape, go maybe to the Russian side, because we're going to be killed anyway, everybody's going to go to Treblinka. And maybe my father and my aunt and uncle would go to Israel at the time with the children. But it was too late and was too much to get started and to sell or get money. Or, you know, you don't always have liquid cash. And this didn't materialize because it was impossible to get out already.
It was impractical, but it was your grandmother's idea.
She thought that should, but it was impossible as far as I remember. And in a couple of days, my father went back and picked up my mother and my little brother and sister, and my aunts and uncle, they came back too. And shortly after that, there was...
And you stayed outside of the city where you had been, or he brought everyone back to the city?
No, when we came back to the city, we went back home.
Yes, okay.
And at that point, you know, my father picked up my mother, my uncle went back and picked up the two families, and we stayed back in our homes for a very short time, like maybe weeks, because right away they tried to make the ghetto.
Tell me what happened, please.
And right in the ghetto, you start living like an animal, because you had to, if you happened to be in the area where the ghetto was, you could stay, but you had to take in other families. But if the ghetto wasn't in the area where your house was not in the area, then you had to go to another. And you used to switch homes with Polish people. This is what happened. We had to switch. And we lived like, they gave you one room for five people. And we stayed in the ghetto, but...
You were in a room of a house that had been owned by Polish people.
My house happened to be in the ghetto. But we were so close with my grandparents that we lived in each other's. But my grandparents had to give up their home,
I see,
a big home, and go and live in a room and you know, exchange for one room with the Polish people.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happened. So. But the family started talking. So first things first, they tried to hide all the four coats. There was a lot in the family. They tried to hide all the gold and valuables, let's put it this way, whatever. My father did a good job on it. And they even tried my uncle's store, which was very close to my father's business, hardware, they made very large boxes like this room and put hardware in it. And they put it in the ground in our yard. They dig big holes and try to save it in case we need money to sell it or whatever. Well, this never came to realization, never. And we tried to hide china, we tried to hide, you know, valuables and crystals and so on. Anyway, after a while, maybe a couple of weeks later, slowly but surely, they took away the business, confiscated the business, the Germans. The school stopped for Jewish children. I never could go back to school.
Were there any education in the ghetto? Did anyone
teach you? No education.
None
at all. This was it. But since we were comfortable people, my mother hired my preschool. When I was maybe 3-4 years old, I used to go to a preschool. She hired this teacher to come to my house in the ghetto.
Was the teacher Jewish?
Yes. And she used to come and teach me a little bit. Yeah. And even my language, I picked up at the time. She started to treat me a little Latin.
Latin? Isn't that interesting? How old were you?
8, 9, 10, that's it. I only went to school maybe for 3 years, but she came in the ghetto and she, you know, we continued. My mother tried to, because the Jewish, especially, I don't know, Jewish families, I understand they push education, that's
they
all what
still
you hear.
And
especially my family, I was never allowed just to sit down. Always pick up a book, pick up. Well, anyway, and after this, there was in our city a factory for bicycles. This factory was they remodeled it to a factory, a Waffenfabrik. That means, Waffen means hard goods.
Metal?
Close it. They transform it to an ammunition factory.
Ammunitions factory.
And soon this was, the family decided that we should start getting into this labor camp in the city, because we knew a lot of Polish people who were clients of ours. And my father paid him under the table to take me in. I was a little, for my age, I was a tall little girl, you know. And my father, my uncle, the three of us went to this ammunition factory to work.
And you had to pay to get in to the
no,
factory?
No, not officially.
Unofficially?
It just
took care of it.
That's all. And we had a lot of clients there. We used to buy lumber to build houses, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we stayed there. Occasionally, we would go home like for a couple of hours to the ghetto, maybe to bring a little clothes or a little food or get money or try to get some, make liquid money from, you know, valuables and so on. So we stayed there till 1944.
And you were at this munitions factory all that time
I
working?
I worked night shift.
And you lived there?
Lived there. I slept on the floor.
On the floor.
And was fortunate because every so often my father would talk to some of these clients from before. He gave him some money, please bring me a loaf of bread, bring me some butter for my daughter. And I always used to cry. After all, I was just a little girl, and it breaks a father's heart. And I worked, I took care of two big machines, make ammunition, night shifts. My feet were swollen, and always with the guns, they were walking around the factory with guns and guns. Anyway, till 1944 in July, I went home that Saturday, and for a few hours. I never came back till after midnight, Saturday midnight. You know, my father told me what to say, and the rest of the family told me. It was bad. Everything smelled bad. And my mother gave me a package with food. She had to stay with the two younger children. But my whole family was already concentrated in one house in the grandmother's. Everybody was there. Whatever will happen goes together. And this was a mistake. Now I see this was a mistake, because my aunts and uncles were young people. Maybe if they would be separate, maybe one would be survived. But since everybody was together. So midnight I came back to that Waffen factory, which they asked my father where I am. My machines were empty, and if I don't show up, my father and my uncle will be killed that night. He said I should be back from the ghetto. Anyway, I came back that midnight, and I got on the back to my machines, and then I told my father what's going on. It's bad. So right then and there, during the night, when nobody was walking with the guns, the SS, he tried to get a policeman who used to watch, take us to the ghetto. He gave him a few dollars that the first thing in the morning, Sunday morning, if we could go back to the ghetto for a few hours to see the family, because it was bad. And when we got dressed in the morning and went down to leave, they wouldn't let us out already. This was a transport getting ready for Treblinka. So a few hours before, I just came back to the factory. And we couldn't go out. And while we were standing at the big gates, before we turned around, we saw the trains passing by. Our family was from the ghetto going to Treblinka.
Did you know they were there? Could you see them?
You can't see, honey. Kettles. This wasn't a train, a normal train. This is a train for kettles. If you saw the picture last night, then you know they put you in like a, what did they care if you die till you get to Treblinka, or you go and you
but
die
you
in
knew
Treblinka.
That your family
this
was
there.
This
was it, because they liquidated the ghetto. This was it. The whole family was there. And next day, I even got regards from a man who came in, and he saw that my dog, because when you have big business like this, you need a watchdog at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I was raised with that dog, a giant. This dog was shot too, because he was crying. He was running after the family, and they even shot the dog. So it was a clear slate. And I just came back, and this shows you to have mazel.
3 hours before.
I came back midnight, maybe 7 in the morning. I was at the gate to go back with my father. Whatever will be, we were ready to be there and to go. Anyway, this was it. And we never went, and this was before Rosh Hashanah, September.
But then what
this
happened?
This was Erev Rosh Hashanah.
Erev Rosh Hashanah.
Erev Rosh Hashanah. 1943, I think. I can't recall now the year. Mm-hmm. I couldn't recall.
Right.
Anyway, we were there. We stayed in that camp. In that labor camp, my father and my uncle. And
what was the name of the camp? Did it have a name?
The Waffenfabrik. I think that I can't even recall if it had anything else. See, my husband, he has a better memory than I. He
was
there too. Well, that's not important. Anyway, we stayed there till 1944 in July, and the Russians were coming closer.
Before we get to the Russians, while you were at the labor camp, what kind of food did you get? What did you do for food?
Well, we used to get in the morning coffee and a slice of bread, and once a day they cooked a meal like dog meat or horse beef with water, which I could not digest. I couldn't eat. I was already like this. I could not touch it. But once in a while, my father would buy from a Polak. Maybe a loaf of bread, maybe a few eggs, or maybe a piece of butter.
Did you have any knowledge or contact with the outside world? Did you have any way of knowing what was going on?
No.
They didn't tell you anything?
In a concentration camp, you only a slave.
Mm-hmm.
You are Jude.
How many hours did you have to work?
12.
And you were on the night shift?
I was a night shift, a weeknight and a weekday shift. And it was very hard on me, of everybody who was there. Anyway,
what would you say in the labor camp, what helped to sustain you? Did you ever think of escaping?
No, there was no place to go, because the Polish people would right away point a finger on you. And even we had so many people we knew, and while we wanted to get off before we went to the labor camp, my family decided to give me, to dress me up in fur coats and fur, my mother's suit with fur collars and so on, blankets and bedspreads, velvet bedspread. This was the thing when my mother got married, and to take it to a Polish family, which we trusted them to, in case we have to sell it, because they were very valuable things. And I took it over to some.
You did?
Yes, myself personally. And I was in danger because I went out from the ghetto. I went to the Polish section.
Mm-hmm.
But I looked a little bit like a Chiksa, you know, and I only worried that they shouldn't recognize me, that this is from the Friedman family.
And the Polish family took it?
Yes. Yeah, of course. Of course.
And did they ever help you or give you any money?
I'm going to come to it.
I'm sorry.
I'm coming to it.
So you put all of your things with them?
Not everything, but
that you could.
A lot of things, yes. Careful, too. Anyway, when we were in 44, they decided they're going to take us to Auschwitz.
How did you hear about that?
Well, my father told me that they're going to liquidate the, because the Russians are coming. Because what did I understand politics? And we're going to... So we walked to Tomaszów.
Could you spell that, please?
Tomaszów. Tomaszów. And we walked 100 miles. I cried through the whole walk. I told my father he's killing me. I want a little water. There was no water. There was nothing. We kept walking and walking. And once in a while in the back we could hear a knock. Like somebody got shot because they couldn't walk. They got swollen feet, they couldn't walk already. So when we were passing my house where we used to live, my father pushed me out from the group. Go in the house, maybe they will help you and you survive because we are going to a death camp. I couldn't comprehend. I said, Daddy, I'm going with you. You're killing me. And I cried and screamed. And I kept going. I said, I'm not going to stay here. We walked a few feet farther. He pushed me again. He said, go in the house. Go. I said, they're going to kill me, they're going to shoot me. And I didn't go. So we wound up in Tomaszów. And Tomaszów, they put us on a train.
Before that was you and your father and your uncle, the three of you together.
That's all was
work. You were walking together.
When just before we went into the trains, we were walking. There was a field with carrots, and I bent it down to pick up a carrot. And I lift my head up. My father was gone. My uncle. In the split second, they took the men away. This was my end. They took us to Auschwitz. They clocked us up in another animal train for cattle. We couldn't breathe. Didn't make any difference anyway. Anyway, we got to Auschwitz. Immediately everybody got undressed. I never forget, my father slipped me in some money.
While you were walking?
A valuable piece of money. When I got to Auschwitz, of course you hand everything over. There was a lady next to me, she knew me as neighbor's children. And I cried to her, and she said, no, don't give it. Put it between your legs. If it falls out, it falls out. If you make it, you make it. I couldn't understand what she was talking to me. Because when you got undressed, once you decide this to death, and this to the crematorium, you decide you have to take a shower. You dip yourself, shaved my head, and that's it, this is it. And I did what she told me. I didn't lose it. I got out from the shower. They gave me those striped dress, and nobody recognized nobody. My friends, my neighbor, we didn't recognize. Then we got situated in the barracks, and we had normal appeals, and we didn't do nothing. The animals were just, we were just, lice were walking all over us, and that's it. And this lasted till the end of 44.
Could you tell me, what do you mean by normal appeals? I don't understand what you're saying.
Appeal. Every morning they come, they take you out from the barracks, and they count you by tens. And every day should be the same amount of people. If one is less, the whole group can get shot, because where is it? Well, maybe somebody is in them, someplace in behind the barrack in the bathroom, you know. So that's an appeal twice a day.
In the morning?
Snow, and at night. Snow, barefooted, cold, shivering. And this lasted till end of 44.
They
needed a transport to Czechoslovakia. I don't know. I could, first of all, the food what they gave us. This particular lady, she's now in Israel.
The one who told you what to do.
What to do. She said that I have to eat. I eat the little water what they gave in Auschwitz. I couldn't swallow. And she made me, she used to hold my face, put a little water in on that can what she used to grab the food for me. And I couldn't swallow. She said, you're not going to make it. You're not going to make it. Look at you. I really and truly did not understand what she's talking about. You're not going to make it. I was talking to my grandmother. I was talking to my parents. I'm a good girl, and I'm going to do what you always taught me. And I was praying to God. I used to go to Hebrew school already.
lady held your mouth open, poured the water in, and kept talking to you.
Yeah, to eat, to drink, because I will never make it. And I truly didn't understand, because I still felt like my mother is talking. All those valuable things they taught me, I was holding on to it. And that's the only way I made it, I swear. And
tell me about the thoughts that went through your mind. What did you remember that sustained you the most?
From home. The good values what a family gives a child. The Jewish home, the freedom, the comfort when you need it. As a little girl, the hugging the doll, that's all what I really remembered.
And you relived that when you were there.
Right, and I was still holding on to those values. And I loved it. I loved it, and this is what kept me going. And that one day they came from that appeal and took out 300 people. And they cut me off from my lunch people.
Your lunchmen.
Right. And they took me to another group and sent me away to Lichtenberg in Czechoslovakia. And this was like end of December, 1st of January. 45.
They separated you from the lady who had been taking care of you also.
From all my landslide. And I was sent away from with people from Krakow. And I was in that camp, Sudetenland, till May the 8th, 1945, when everybody was liberated.
Tell me about that.
We still were there.
You were there?
Yes.
Did you expect that the war was going to be over? Did you have any way of knowing anything?
Animals. What do we know? We were called only by the number. Not that they called me by number, they didn't have no conversation with me. Animals, in and out. That's all. But in Czechoslovakia, they took us to a camp. And from camp every day we walked like maybe 3 miles to work to a factory where they make string.
String?
Yeah, to wrap packages. You know, thin, thick. And when we got there, yeah, and I was with all strangers, which was very hard for me. Very hard. And I was like an animal going back and forth and working with these machines, making string. The lice were all over me. I was shaking myself to shake off. It was a horrible scene. The food was the same like we got in Auschwitz. Nothing was better. And
how many times a day were you fed?
Once a day. We came back for lunch, if you call it lunch. And there was soup on the tables prepared. But this was two ladies from Czechoslovakia. They were young women, and they were the Aufsehers.
Overseers.
Yes. But in German, the Aufsehers. They felt sorry for me, these two ladies. And they took me, when we walked into the dining area, they gave me their dish of soup, because their dish of soup had a potato. And mine was just water. So they, every day for lunch, they gave it to me, till some of the ladies noticed. And they said that I'm buying them off, because they were jealous that they gave me the potato.
The potato in the soup.
In their soup, because they could go back and get another portion. So they gave me their first portion because I had a potato, because I was like this. And anyway, then they couldn't give me this potato anymore.
After the other people in the camp complained?
Yes. No, they didn't complain. There was nobody to complain, but they just, hey, how comes you have a potato in your soup, you know? And I said no, because I was a very proud little girl. The pride what I had from my family sticks today, and I gave it to my children. Pride. Never be ashamed. Speak out. Do what you think is right. My pride, even at that time, even I was treated like an animal, nobody could take my pride away. Nobody. Because this was in me.
Inside.
You can take it away. So,
how did you feel when you lost the potato? Were you...
I couldn't care less.
No?
No. Because you knew there's not going to be no tomorrow. This was today. And unbelievable. You covered with lice. That's how it's a terrible scene. And we worked till that day. One day,
tell me about
the man who was in charge of that factory,
of the string factory,
he arranged for us to come, a group of people, like every Saturday, to work. They needed more strings to support the Germans. They need the pack, the gold, the diamonds from the Jews. So I was picked on Saturdays to come to work. His wife was the manager on the floor, and he had a daughter, 15 years old. She was so big like a horse with a big pigtail, strong, big. She was such an SS girl, Hitlerjugend. It was unbelievable. One day she came up to my machine and she went through me twice like this over my face. And I was bleeding. She busted a vein in my nose from hitting me on both sides. She was such a big elephant, that girl.
She slapped you without reason.
You didn't have to have a reason. She's an SS. She's in the Hitlerjugend. And she was about 15, 16 years old, but just a tremendous big girl. And I was full of blood, and I had nothing even to hold on to stop my... Well, anyway, she busted a vein in my nose, which I suffered till the day. And his wife was an SS lady, too. Of course, he must have been from a party, the man, but he was an angel. He arranged for us to come on Saturday to work. As he walked in, when he opened the door, he was dropping from both pockets potatoes. So the girls could pick up a potato. We really didn't have to come to work.
He just did that to help you.
He has a husband, a wife, and a daughter.
So different.
And he did not like to bring his wife on a Saturday for her to see the
what
pockets.
He was doing.
So I was very fortunate to pick up a potato, and I ate it up like in 2 seconds. And he was such a nice man. Just for that, he was nice.
Of course.
This went on. One day, the girls start talking, the ladies, well, mothers had children my size.
Right.
They had the girls and the children. I heard them saying, and then I understood German from so many years to be around, that they were going crazy in my camp, the SS and the woman SS. They were beating us with the rubber hoses, and they were completely getting crazy. I couldn't understand why, but it looked to us, we start talking. I overheard in the barracks that the Russians are coming. And there were leaflets from the Russians. And I understand there were leaflets saying, if one person is gonna miss from those 300 people who are in this camp, the whole village will go on fire. But the SS people who were in charge, they couldn't care less. They knew that they're gonna go, they're dead. So this was going on a couple of days. And this gentleman who was in charge,
the nice man.
Yes. I don't remember his name, who knew names. He came in and he gave little tips to the women, the older women, what's going on. So we could hear the children, the young people, we could hear something. So we knew that something is going on. And
you overheard them talking?
Yes. And no food, they were cooking in the kitchen. Something was going on. And this was going on for a couple of days. Then one day they started cooking and they made such a thick soup with potatoes and horse beef that we thought that somebody got crazy. Anyway, no guards were at the doors at the camp and on the
barbed wire.
On the wires, you know, when the SS sits with the guns, nobody was there.
When you came out in the morning?
In the morning, one morning, a couple days later. But this gentleman came in every day and talked to us. He said that any minute the Russians will occupy, and not to be afraid. He said, if you want to turn me in, you can. I don't care, you know, as an assessment. But I'm going to stay with you till they come in.
Wasn't that wonderful?
The SS people and the women SS, they disappeared. No. The young women SS, we're not talking about his wife. They were in charge of that camp. They disappeared because they were afraid that we will turn them in immediately, they will get shot. And he stayed. The next morning, we saw Russians on horses coming in. And one Russian was a Jew. And he said, are you Yehuda? You know what Yehuda is?
Yes.
And he stayed with us because he was afraid that the Russians would take advantage of the young
of the women.
Women, like me, 14 years old, 15 years old, we were maybe a group of 10, 12, maybe 7, there were people 17 years old, but myself and another girl was the youngest. The mother was with her. We were the two youngest ones. But the mothers already, like women who, you know, they tried to protect little girls like us. So he stayed. And we told the women, went out and they spoke to the Russians and told them this was our angel. And he, but nothing happened to him. No. Nothing happened. What happened to his wife and that daughter? Should God only punish them for me? I really had an opportunity to see her. And they encouraged me to go beat her up, kill her, do something to her. But I didn't have a heart. I wasn't brought up that way. I just couldn't punish her. That girl who...
What do you mean you had the opportunity? What happened?
We found her a couple of days after we were liberated in the village.
You found her in the village?
She was in a house, or maybe this was her house. And everybody said that we should kill her. We didn't have the courage, nobody. And I personally was beaten up from her. The first thing I went out, I didn't go for clothes or nothing. I went into a house and looked for a little bit salt. I didn't have soul for so many years.
That was what you looked for.
That's
first.
That's what I needed. My body was so neglected. A drop of salt. I went into a house and took a drop of salt. We found in those homes so much fruit. It could last it for another 10 years for the Germans. In barrels. Flour, sugar, cocoa, tea, potatoes in these basements, apples, preserves, food prepared for years. If the war would go on for another 5 years, they had plenty to eat. And we couldn't get a drop of salt. So in a couple of days later, I didn't know where I'm going, what I'm doing. We left.
Who was we?
The people from that camp.
Together.
But they all went in groups because they went back to Krakow, and I was the only one from Radom. But till a certain point, you know, I went with the group. I can't even recall how we walked. And we used to hitchhike a ride from the Russians, and it was very dangerous after all. And we got, I finally got to Radom, to the railroad station. And I walked home from the railroad station. I came into my house, I rang the bell, because we had gates in a lumber yard, you know. So we still had the gates, and I was ringing the bell outside, just the way my grandfather, my father set up. And I went back to the house. And it's a funny thing, I didn't go to my house, I went to my grandmother's.
Your grandmother's.
This is how close everybody always there. And I'm ringing the bell. It was 6 o'clock in the morning, and a gentleman was passing by. He came back by over to me. He recognized the house. He said, "Sala." I said, "Yes." "Don't you remember me?" I said, "No." "I'm Lesch." He was a friend of my family.
You didn't recognize him?
No. But he used to come in, I was 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years old. And here I'm coming from a desert. I never saw a human being in the last 6 years. So I talked to him in Polish, of course. And he told me that my neighbors, a home. They had a factory from Harper's toilet seats, dishes, and they home. They survived. And to the husband and wife, he said, "The only thing I can tell you, go up to the Rottenbergs, and you see who is here, see what's going on." Anyway, I thanked them. And this lady from my grandmother's house came out, opened the door, and these were the tenants what were still living when my grandparents had the house, because there was an extra house for tenants. And I said to her, I remember her name, Atratska, and she said, the first word she said, "You still alive?" And she remembered when I was born. I said, "Yes, how about it? I'm alive." And I kept marching right into to my yard. And I walked into the kitchen, occupied the whole house, everything. So she gave me a lesson. You know, all the Jews are killed.
She said to you?
Yes. She gave me a bed, believe it or not. And she told me to go to sleep. It occurred to me that they can poison me, you know. Now I'm thinking about it. So I went to sleep. When I woke up, she had potatoes and borscht and liver.
For you?
Well, for the family, so,
yes.
And I ate too. First time in my life I'm having a meal now. And I was afraid to eat that I'm not going to digest.
I understand.
I don't know. I ate maybe a little bit. I don't know. So I said to her, you know what? Since you live here, and I know you from before, you know, give me the last bedroom for myself, and I stay here. Because I could go in from the bedroom with another key. My grandmother's house was built. You could go in from the kitchen on one side, and all in the back from the bedroom on the other side. She said, you know, Sally, it's not a good idea to stay here. They're still killing if they find out there's a Jew around. I said, well, I have no place to go. I don't know. I just came. I just stayed. And her brother was a teacher. And he talked to me a little bit. And they told me to go to the Rottenbergs, too.
The neighbors.
Yeah. But... four blocks. They were my neighbors across the street from my house.
Your house.
And from my grandparents, I had to go like four blocks. So I thought to myself, well, let's go see a Jew. I came over to the Rottenbergs. They didn't know me. But they knew the whole family. I said, I'm from the Freedmen's, the apple across the street. Oh my God, and she kissed me, and she hugged me. And she said, stay here, don't go no place. It's not good, because they're still searching for the Jews, the Polacks themselves. So I said, look, I don't have anything. I have no clothes, I have no money, I can't buy food, and I don't even know where what to do. They told me not to worry. As long as they're here, I eat with them. But as I said, I'm a very proud person. And I had it. I wasn't brought up poor, you know, there was always called death. So I said, well, I'm going to go to some of our clients, collect things, or they should give me money so I have something to live on. And by the way, my money, what I had in Auschwitz, what my father gave
the coin.
I saved it until I came back to Poland, and I sold it to buy a piece of bread.
Oh my. All those years.
This was worth a lot of money, a lot of money, even today.
Your father was smiling when you ate the bread. I'm sure your father was smiling in his heart when you bought the bread.
Well, he was dead already.
I know.
And I went to those Gentiles, neighbors, when I took the stuff. I walked in and I said, you recognize me? You're still alive.
Everyone.
I said, yes, I'm alive, but you know, I like to have my bedspreads back because I want to sell, or you want to keep them, give me money. I have no money. He said, and I said, I'd like to have the suits back for my mother, my aunt. Beautiful four colors. One was a fine color, a two-piece, such gorgeous stuff. And I was just picturing myself, so I'm going to wear it.
All dressed up.
With black Persian. The Germans came in and they took everything away. And I started crying. You know, I was full of tears. So when I start crying,
how was my
the door opens, and his daughter comes in, wears my mother's suit, the vine suit. Look at my heart. I said, look,
there's
you told me the Germans took your rice. I said, I know you have everything. So he said, you know what, I'm going to give you a plate of lima beans. I took the lima bean, flipped it over, and I cried so hard. And all my tears from the whole time, what I never cried, I was like an animal. I cried so hard, I didn't know where to turn, what to do.
But this happened right away then.
A day later, I met my girlfriend with her mother. She came to look for her father. The reason I came back, because I thought maybe my uncle and my father's alive. So I met my girlfriend and her mother, and I asked her if her father's alive, because they all the men went to the same camp. And a day later, she heard her father's alive, and he's on the way looking for her mother and her. So Mr. Weisbord came next day, and I was there, and I said, Mr. Weisbord, whatever you do, I'm going with you. You have two daughters now. Take me. Do something with me. Take me. No, I don't know where to go. Anyway, in a few days, right away we left. We went to Germany, to Stuttgart. On the way was very hard to get on trains. I didn't have a piece of paper. I didn't know who I am. And they wouldn't let you in the trains. Anyway, somebody was there and said, I take on my paper, a man who survived another camp. I said, she's my wife, big girl. And he told me to close my eyes when they come in to check the papers and not to open my
eyes. Pretend you're asleep.
Yes, so you're tired, maybe they don't wake you up because through Czechoslovakia when we were riding the train, maybe they don't wake you up. If they wake me up, I was in trouble. Thank God they didn't wake me up. We got to Germany, to Stuttgart, and this is where I stayed. I met a lot of my landslide, Radomes, men and women, and I heard what happened to my father, how he died a day before the liberation. Some people took me in, I lived with the people. And then
In Stuttgart,
then my husband was, thank God, he had two brothers, which one brother just passed away 7 years ago, and the other one is in Israel. They said, as long as you going together, you know, we knew each other, why don't you get married? They married me off already. I didn't know what marriage is, I'll be honest. Well, and we got married, and my brother-in-law, my whole family was big Zionists, so they want to go to Israel. But this much I understood, that I just don't have the strength to work. And I said, I want to go to the United States. So my husband, well, we weren't married, but we were talking. I said, if you want to go with your brothers, you should. I mean, after all. I said, I'm going to try and go to the United States on a children's quota so I can have a chance to go back to school. And that's it. No, so they want us to get married. And my husband decided that he wants to come too. So one of my brother-in-laws, myself, my husband, we came to the United States. And we got settled in Wilmington. I raised a beautiful family of two children, professional. They were very normal people, beautiful, not beautiful looking, which they are, but beautiful big hearts.
Inside.
They very much involved with the second generation. The grandchildren now are learning already about it. Whatever I see, I buy for the grandchildren now, so they will have and not to forget. And I have books. I give it to them so mommy and daddy can read to them. And thank God now I'm here. That's all what I have to say.
Sarah, you were wonderful to share your experiences with us.
It's too bad that I have to share such an experience.